No, but when I talk about love, I'm talking about the most difficult, the most dangerous, the most subversive force in the world. Because when you're talking about love, it means you have a steadfast commitment to the well-being of others, and you're willing to do what it takes to ensure that their humanity is always affirmed. Always affirmed. That's what I mean by love supreme. When John Coltrane's talking about love supreme, he's just not playing the saxophone. He's talking about his heart, his mind, his soul is a steadfast commitment to make sure that the well-being of all of humanity is elevated, and the best he can do is play his horn, just as the best we can do is occupy at the moment.
Hello, hello, welcome to the Radical Righteous Love webcast. And I'm joined tonight, back from a long absence, Shante Brown.
Hey. Hello.
Hi there.
How's it going, Charlie?
Going to go real radio here. Anyway,
how's going,
welcome
Charlie?
Back. I haven't seen you in person yet, but this will have to do for now. Welcome back. So tonight, we have a couple of things on there. We had a couple of things on here. Police violence and racism, which is what Black Lives Matter. I used that hashtag, Black Lives Matter. But we also, you suggested that we talk about power. So we'll bring that into this conversation. Then we'll talk just, you know, a couple of other things as it goes along. So so how are you? Let's welcome back. Let's bring you back in. How are things been going? What's new and exciting in your life? And we'll start there.
Where do I start? At the moment, I'm pretty culture shocked, to say the least.
Okay.
I came back from being in France for like a month and a half, couple weeks ago, and it's really disturbing to hear about the things that are happening in America when I would check in. I don't really have to deal much with racism in France, and it was really something that it was pretty profound to me the first time I went there many years ago, and I got to kind of remember that feeling of not being judged for my skin everywhere I went. Wow, what a difference that makes.
Really?
But it's just normal there. And then I would check in to see the news and hear about all the stuff happening. And it's not just the race thing. There's a lot. But so just coming back into kind of the kind of chaos of the politicized and segregated world in the city. Yeah. But within that, there's also something really nice here. There's like a really nice house I live in at the moment, and everyone in the house is involved in a lot of community work. So I've been getting to see a lot of really inspiring things that make me feel about the world and just the power of people. So other than that, I'm just just trying to get to know my community a little bit better, getting to spend more time with friends, enjoying life more, trying to not get too distracted by chaos that is media.
Right.
Yeah, that pretty much wraps it up.
Well, you're certainly not the first person I've heard who says that about France. I seem to remember that it was either Richard Wright or James Baldwin, maybe both of them, who said it's so different in France that, like, they ignore the fact that you're just like any other person.
Yeah, it's just you're just treated as a French person. I mean, I can't speak for – I have – I think it's a different thing if you're culturally – they have definitely bigotry in the country, like it's very apparent, but it seems to be based on different things, and it's a shame that it can be such a relief when you don't have to deal with one of those categories. It should be, you know, no discrimination, of course, with anything,
right?
But just to compare with dealing with that on a daily basis on many levels. It definitely makes a difference. I just wish people could understand. I think if people understood what it was like, they wouldn't want to put somebody else in that position. But
yeah.
That's it. We need to care.
It's really tough. I mean, and of course, you know the events of last week with the Charlie Hebdo satire.
Yes.
I've heard it called a newspaper, heard it called a magazine. It was shot up. 12 people were killed. It was apparently Muslims, at least that's some video footage or audio footage. They heard Allah Akbar or something, you know. So that's why that's what they say. I've heard there were people held, you know, there were another hostage situation later on in the week. So, you know, that country is really roiling with it. Of course, there were actually a few years ago a series of riots that were largely Muslim youth men, young men who were, you know, trashing streets and buildings and cars and, you know, going on a rampage because they just can't find decent jobs.
There's a lot of tension because, like I say, the discrimination when it comes to religion is pretty apparent, even as a foreign visitor. But, of course, I've talked to friends that live there and to hear their opinion on the matter. And it's definitely biased. And then also if you're coming from a certain country that is seen as intimidating to a market or to a way of life, they're not assimilating or they're not speaking French or both, and they're practicing very proudly the religion, and they are having successful businesses and creating more and more families. To me, that's why I wanted to bring it back to power, because this is just, that's what it always goes back to for me. I'm always looking for the root. And it's really just, it's fear of power or fear of losing power. And I think that whenever a group seems like they might be jeopardizing the power of the larger power, larger power has a lot of might, you know, as their tool in or incarceration. They need that because you got to protect your power, you know?
Right. Yeah, I this is ringing bells for me because this afternoon I went to see Selma, which for anybody listening, this is a fantastic movie. I mean, for years, when the Malcolm X movie came out, like two, 3 decades ago, I kept thinking, where is the Martin Luther King movie that's as good cinematically?
Yeah.
And this comes so close. I mean, it may even be better. I'd have to see it again to say it was better than Malcolm X, but it captures a moment when his sort of what he'd been doing in Alabama and, you know,
ripped
the entire nation. Yeah, it's great. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is you know, having done some, because I'm, for people who don't know, I think you know, I've been getting a degree in political science. And one of the classes I took was called Democratic Transitions, which is about countries where you had little or no political rights, you weren't able to really vote, and like Spain was one, you know, after World War II, Francisco Franco ran the country basically as a dictatorship, sort of like a small scale of what Hitler did inside of Germany. Some people, they debate over whether Franco was actually a fascist, but it's pretty darn close. And so that was sort of the beginning, but then the instructor of the class has actually done research on what he calls sub-national authoritarian regimes, and Alabama is one of those, because this movie focuses on George Wallace and, of course, Lyndon Johnson and then King. Those are sort of the big three power players here. And then there's the sheriff of Selma. And so they're talking, you know, and he's, you know, there's this big confrontation between LBJ and George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, and it's just so clear that the governor of Alabama, you know, George Wallace just knows that he has all the power in that state, you know, and that he's not going to do any, he's not going to let it go. He's not going to let the black people vote and vote him and the sheriff out. And, you know, he doesn't want to let black people vote. And that's what it was all about. That was the big brouhaha with voting rights. And that's when LBJ said, well, you're on the wrong side of history. I'm going to have to shut you down. And he did. But it took, you know, people getting killed and beaten to get LBJ's attention. And it's a complex movie. It's beautiful. But, you know, you talk about the power struggle. And in France, there's nervousness about Muslims, people from Africa and maybe other Arabic countries coming, having big families. And when French have hardly any kids, you know, their birth rate is like below one or 0.5 per family.
I heard that a lot.
Yeah. So there's worried that they're going to be displaced, you know, from immigrating Muslims. And of course, the question is, why are they immigrating? Well, because their economies are in pretty rotten shape, in part, you know, from the legacy of colonial treatment of both Arabic and African countries by Europe and the United States. We've sort of kept their economies hobbled. And so when they can get out, they do.
Yeah, it's crazy how, it kind of spins around. We're supposed to be convinced somehow that the problems are always, you know, the victims of these injustices.
Right.
And that's the thing that is, like, kind of, it's the most appalling, I think, like, you know, it's such a, just like, I don't want to change the subject too much, but the whole,
I think we're on the subject.
You know, with the hot, the hot word for a moment was this click in people's heads to think about rape culture, you know?
Right.
Just like thinking about that metaphorically with a lot of the structures that are in place and just behavior. It's about lack of respect, and it's about, you know, deeper than that. It's a hatred that's clearly based on some sort of fear, and that's why I just keep tracing it back to power,
right.
You know, fear of this power being lost, and just it's greed too. But at some point, it's just not going to work anymore. But the question is how to get to that point. How do we actually stop this from happening?
Right. Yeah, and I don't know what it is. I mean, watching that movie gave me some ideas because it's so different now than it was. But then again, the civil rights movement that we had, you know, the 50s, and this was focused on the year of 1965. But before, I mean, the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott began in December of 55. So, I mean, that's 9 years and counting that it took them to get to that point of fighting for voting rights. You know, they desegregated buses and they desegregated lunch counters. And, you know, then they moved to now we want to be able to vote. And, you know, it's... And that's the thing is, I don't know, you know, and there are some people who criticize King, you know, say, well, he did all these compromises and he didn't really grip the power in his hands as tightly as some African-Americans like the Black Power movement wanted him to. And I think there's some truth in that. But on the other hand, in the United States, with the overwhelming power of the so-called white majority, it's really... I don't know. I think I don't know what could we do now? Because what's happened now, I don't know if you've heard of the phrase, the new Jim Crow. Michelle Alexander wrote a book about the rise in criminalizing African-American male youth mostly, but also African-American women, but it falls heaviest on young men. And They give them substandard public schooling. Young African American men hard to get a job. The highest unemployment rate in the country is that part of the population, and so they are sort of pushed into criminal behavior because they come almost to survive. They have to steal or sell drugs or whatever, and so they're criminalized, you know, incarcerated. So now we have this huge prison population of I think it's more than half are African-American males, and yet African-Americans are only 10% of the population. So it's this huge discrepancy. And, you know, Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow just talks about the history of where the civil rights movement kind of stepped back because there was a group of African-Americans who'd sort of broken through the glass ceiling a little bit. And they, you know, during the Lyndon Johnson administration and even somewhat during the Richard Nixon administration. And then it all kind of came crashing down and like said, okay, you can keep what you gain, but we're going to go after those young black criminals. And by making, you know, for the majority of the offenses are nonviolent. Often they're selling marijuana or possessing marijuana.
Oh yeah.
Even in Chicago where, even in Chicago where supposedly Rahm Emanuel said, we're going to stop arresting for possession. They're still getting arrested for possession because I look at the police blotter. And in Rogers Park, that's the number one cause of arrest is possession of marijuana. And it's so. And even though the mayor said, well, we're going to not enforce this law, he can't keep the police from enforcing it because it's how they control a population that they don't trust. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. And so this.
And that's the. And that goes to the broader problem of prison. The prison industrial complex and all of that, but it's impossible to avoid the connection if you really see a connection between the system. Like this, like for instance, for people that don't believe, it's a problem yet. Because I know there's people out there that really don't see the big deal. They don't really think that there's a problem. But I would say most people see the problem because if you just look at the statistics, just like you mentioned, and it's the same if you look at prison population in America, just as like a statistic, most crimes, most people that are in prison are in there for nonviolent crimes, mostly related to drug offenses, which of course is an illness.
Or like I said, a job. They sell it to pay for stuff that they can't.
And it's just it's the problem that also that it's not that the majority of people that are committing these so-called crimes are the majority are minorities because that's not the case. I've seen so many studies that have proven, like, as far as, you know, what I think is silly to be illegal anyway, but, I mean, it's a freaking herb.
We can disagree. We can agree on that one, that marijuana doesn't deserve to be illegal.
Obviously, there's many more drugs on the street, but you know what I'm saying.
There's other drugs that we might have an issue, but, yeah.
But it's okay to sell, to have liquor stores on every block. That's totally fine. It's very fun. it's very maniacal when I think about it. I try not to think about it that way, but it's an obvious kind of setup, as you say. There's like you said, like they're kind of like tricked into this sort of problems, this cyclical problem. Mm-hmm. But I'm really wanting to get towards solutions and just like ideas of how to shift the mindset of everyone involved, because I feel like in order for a real change to happen, there always needs to be like kind of a change in the way we think about things. And then, of course, the people that we're wanting to change our laws and our behavior that don't believe this, we need to somehow connect to them, you know.
Right.
Whether it be through hearts and minds or through, like, legislation. I'm curious about your ideas, Charlie, because I know we have a little bit of different beliefs when it comes to the role of government. So I'm just curious.
Yeah.
What would be your practical – can we talk about maybe – if you wanted to share more on what we were talking about, that's fine too. But I'm just curious kind of what would you think is some practical solutions to kind of – either reverse or get ourselves out of this this desperate situation or in this chaos.
And again, I don't know. Thank you for the question. I wish I said, these things, these, and as someone who at least for a white guy, I think I try to pay attention to race politics. I don't know how I got hooked into it. I guess I went to an integrated school in elementary, mm-hmm. like 5th and 6th grades was a fully mm-hmm. integrated school. And that was the first time I heard the I Have a Dream speech played over the school PA. Mm-hmm. It was on his birthday. Yeah. It wasn't a holiday yet, but they played it on his birthday. And I remembered that sermon had this huge impact on me. And so I've always, you know, there maybe been periods of times where I wasn't in touch with it. But ever since I came to Chicago in 86 and have lived in racially diverse neighborhoods and had racially mm-hmm. diverse mm-hmm. workplaces, it's like, I care about this mm-hmm. issue, and I want to know, you know, I don't know what the solution is. I mean, to me, legalizing marijuana is like number one. Do that.
Yeah.
You know, stop putting yeah. people away just for possessing yeah. or even yeah. selling. That, to me,
it'll
is the first
difference.
Stop that. Yeah, because that would cut the prison population by at least a third, if not more. And then, I mean, of course, education. Mm-hmm. The schools in the inner cities are awful. They don't teach, you know, and I realize, I mean, we have a mutual friend, Charlotte, who has taught.
I have quite
in
a few teachers, actually, too.
Well, you and I have the mutual in Charlotte who yeah. has taught in majority black schools for most of her public education career. Mm-hmm. And she's now in Boston public schools, but she was in Chicago public schools for many years mm-hmm. and just said it's yeah. frustrating. You bang your head against the wall. Trying to help out,
yeah.
but you don't have any money, and the principals are,
yeah,
you know, cronies for the system. They don't really try to keep the school.
Right.
You know, so
I've heard this a lot.
Chicago
too.
Is a horrible.
I've heard that a lot.
Yeah, and Chicago shut down schools. I mean, in a city where you've got a crisis of, you know, African American poverty, and you shut down schools. Mm-hmm. Why do you shut down schools when these kids need
and I
an
heard,
education?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. I heard from a friend I haven't hadn't talked to in a while from Philly, and they were telling me that they shut down a lot of schools there too, like maybe even
yeah.
more than we did. And Philly's pretty small, so that's a big deal.
Right. Right, and that's the thing is that this is where I have to say in the short term I'm pessimistic, and I will say the last time I kind of was optimistic was in the early Obama administration years, you know, 2010, when he was seemingly fighting for something. But then as soon as that midterm election came along and he got a Republican majority in the House of Reps, he couldn't pass anything anymore, the health care. And so I'm like, I could see where the handwriting on the wall is unless we were able, you know, to. And again, I'm not a huge Democrat. I identify further left. I tend to vote Green or Socialist. But you
right.
know, when the Democratic Party could not keep their majority, they came in with a majority in 2008, and they've been fought tooth and nail. And I can go back to power. I think that there is a element in this country. We sometimes call them the 1%. You know, that's mm-hmm. Occupy Wall Street kind of gave us that. They're more than 1%, but they are. The 1% is definitely in this class of, and here we go, I'm being socialist. There's this class of people who have a vested interest in not letting poor people get a better education, get better jobs, and so on. They want to keep reducing the amount of social welfare spending, and you know, and they've been fighting this fight since since the Carter administration, but maybe even under Nixon some. You know, they've just been fighting, oh, there's too many welfare queens, and there's too many, you know, there's too much money going to schools and too much
and
money going
to very
this.
Least, and at the very least, for instance, because I have a lot of different kinds of friends and a lot of different beliefs, and I'm picturing different friends in my head, like what they might say in this conversation. And hopefully we'll be able to talk to some people out there too tonight. But
yeah.
I'm just thinking there's people that wouldn't believe what you just said. So if the very least they don't take that, they have to consider the kinds of entities and people, I mean corporations really, that
mm-hmm.
they're supporting.
Yeah.
So even if you don't believe that they're trying to hold down the little man, who they're propping up and who they keep continually bailing out and helping up and making invincible, making immune to any kind of responsibility, accountability, and so forth, it's pretty obvious. So just given that information, people should kind of question that just based on, you know, history at the very least.
Yeah.
They're the kind of person who doesn't even believe in, you know, this systematic slavery. They have to, come on, like, that should be scary for everyone, you know?
Right, and I mean, who, you know, and I mean, when I was coming up and thinking about this stuff, I mean, I probably had imbibed, because in the mid-70s, it was becoming fashionable to be an economic conservative. There was even a PBS miniseries about the freedom of the market. And I remember my dad watching it, and I was, you know, barely a teenager and didn't really pay close attention, but I didn't buy the idea that, well, there's too many people on welfare and there's too much, you know, too much of this and too much of that, government spending. And so government was kind of the bad guy. And then Ronald Reagan won on that platform, basically. And I didn't know what to think, because at first I thought he was okay, but then he started cutting like money for colleges that affected not just African-Americans, but you know, working class white kids like me. He took away a lot of college money for us. And that was the beginning of my, wait a minute, is this really, So I've studied other things and looked as I've paid attention to politics. But to come back to, I guess, to the racial question, although the racial question, I don't separate it entirely from the class question. I think that African-Americans serve a function of being sort of the class that we dump everything on. You know, we put all of our toxic waste dumps in their neighborhoods.
Scapegoat.
And the bad schools, we give them the really bad schools. We give
them the poor people in general.
Bad housing,
general.
You know, the housing that nobody wants anymore. We give it to them, you know, the decaying whatever, you know, decaying sewer lines. We give them the worst of the leftovers, and, you know, that nobody really wants anymore. And that's just been, you know, the pattern for hundreds of years in this country. And but I don't think that it's the white majority that's necessarily keeping the black minority down. I think that there is a special class at the top of the white majority, this 1%, this 2%, this 10%, whatever you want to call it, because I don't put a number on it. It's just, you know, people who have a lot of power and who can control the government. I don't think it's private corporations are only the bad guy. I also don't think government's only the bad guy. I think they're working together.
Of course they are, because they're making each other secure.
They're mutually enriching one another, you know?
It's funny, because a lot of the laws are supposed to be for our security, and we have had this whole push since, you know, especially 2001, for, you know, security, more security, more security. And it's funny, because almost everyone I've talked to, you know, I range in different kinds of fields and age groups, don't feel very secure, you know? So I just always wonder, okay, like, what justification do they have? Like, what justification could anyone possibly have for continuing these parts of this toxic system to continue? Like, it would have to be, you just utterly do not value, and it's getting back to the subject of, you know, this movement, Black Lives Matter. So if they mattered, then it wouldn't be a big deal. People wouldn't have to die, get tear gassed, and fight and march for this thing. It would just kind of be a given. Okay, we have to make sure that we are doing what we can to protect our citizens, all of them. If there's a problem with abortion, you know, if there's being obvious discrimination, this has to end, because our citizens are valuable. We are our citizens. Like, but obviously that's like a fairy tale. It's pretty obvious that's not the case.
We
protect the things that we value. That's with anything.
Right. You faded away. Are you still there?
I'm still
Hello?
Here.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm not hearing you.
How about now? I'm not talking.
Okay. You weren't talking. Sorry. You weren't talking. Okay, good.
Yeah.
I apologize. You trailed off there a little, and I wasn't sure if you were actually stopped talking. So let's see. So the Black Lives Matter, the Ferguson situation, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, you had the Mike Brown murder by a police officer, and I actually, in the class that I'm in now on social protest, they actually took us through the timeline of, you know, the murder, the police, what the police did immediately after the murder, you know, the, and then how it sort of progressed, and then they sent it to a grand jury, and then the grand jury, you know, came back with, and that was the weirdest part about the Fergus, the Mike Brown case, is that a grand jury's job is not to decide was he, did Mike Brown, you know, did the officer have the right to shoot? All they have to argue is that there is a question that he might not have. In other words, there's, they have to decide that there is at least some evidence that needs to be reviewed by a criminal, by a civil court or a criminal court for this, this incident. And that's supposed to take a few weeks. Well, it took over like a month and a half. Because the prosecutor essentially, and it turns out the prosecutor has a family member who was a cop who was shot in the line of duty. So he has long been a, you know, pro-police prosecutor. And so he, or district attorney, I guess, and he basically tried the case before the grand jury instead of, and he didn't let the officer, the cop, speak to the grand jury, but he didn't let anybody else criticize the cop's story. It was just he told, the cop told his story, and we have the full transcript of what the cop said, but nothing refuting anything the cop said, which a true prosecution would have gotten in there and taken the story apart, which people have since done.
Right.
But, you know, so it's a case of, here's the system, you know, it's like you got the people at the top are not playing honestly with the people, you know, the,
right,
the ordinary people and not in power.
It's like a game you play with, it's like a game you play with like a little kid or something.
Yeah.
Knowing that. And like, it's, you made up a silly game.
It is. It's like, we're going to, you know, we're going to make you think that we're giving this a reasonable assessment.
Right.
But then they think.
Yeah.
Now, of course, to on top of this, because I think Eric Garner died before Mike Brown. This was New York. So this was the other case that sort of added fuel to the Ferguson, the Mike Brown protest, was when Eric Garner got chokeholded and suffocated under a chokehold. Basically, his throat was crushed by a cop doing an illegal chokehold. And it was on tape, and yet a grand jury, again, in New York, said there's no probable cause for
being in the court.
And so, boom, New York goes up. You know, now we got Ferguson in flames, and now we got New York in flames. Like, and you know, it raises the question, well, you know, it's not nonviolent. At least some people say it is. I mean, most protesters are nonviolent. Yes, there have been riots. Yes, there have even been one person who was apparently psychotic who shot a couple of cops. And some people are like, where's Dr. King? What would Dr. King do? And I, you know, having watched the movie Selma, I agree that the situation is so different than it was back then, because back then you had a number of, I mean, you had not only a Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Dr. King's organization, you had the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee who were trying to do their thing. You had NAACP doing their bit. Every, you know, there were all
the family structure
American
was pretty different too. Family structure.
The families were
like
a little more intact.
Structure.
It was the South too. It was the South. The South was a different thing than the North, and these are happening in the North. It's Ferguson and New York. They're not Southern, you know, Southern. I mean, even though Ferguson or St. Louis, Missouri, was a part of the Confederacy, it was not really a part of the plantation thing like Alabama was. You know, Alabama is a different case than what Missouri was, the culture of Missouri. They're totally, even though they're on the same side in the Civil War, they were not similar cultures. So Ferguson is more the northern situation, as is New York. And it's, I don't know what, because this Dr. King came to Chicago and basically held a couple of marches and parades, and it didn't go anywhere. I mean, there was a riot in Cicero. White people rioted when Martin Luther King went into Cicero. Or, you know, he did not have a lot of effect in Chicago when he came north on the poverty that was already in place that we still see on the south side of Chicago.
But if you were to be, well, it's hard to say. I can't really say if you were to be alive today, I wonder what would happen.
What would you do?
It doesn't really matter, I guess, in the end. It's what can we do now, you know?
Yeah.
How do we how do we act in the way of our, you know, our prophets and our mentors and, you know, our ancestors that got us the things we have now? And how do we logically react to, well, maybe react is not the right way, but, you know.
But how do we,
how do we
how
respond?
Do we,
how
do we mobilize?
To,
how do we?
Yeah. How do we figure this out?
How do we get our power? And I can't, I think about this a lot. And I know there are smarter people than me who think about this. And, you know, they're trying to do what they can, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you said it
mobilized.
It's about power. Once again, it comes back to the power. Because the only way that they have the power is if we have to participate, we have to give it to them. But what if, you know, we create a strong community base that doesn't even, you know, needs not rely on police, basically. And the ones that do have the police present, it's not their... for a reason, just like in New York, they've, I don't know if they're, what's the situation now, but have you read these reports about the police being off work for so long? They haven't hasn't been as much problems.
Well, the police in New York are kind of doing a work slowdown. They're protesting the fact that the mayor of New York criticized them mildly.
Right.
No. But, I mean, come on. He did an illegal chokehold. I mean, that's indisputable. And whether or not it was illegal.
It's pretty
and
simple.
They're like, oh, you're not defending the police. Well, wait a minute.
It says you're above the law. If you don't agree with that statement and you're a police officer, it's like doubly negative. It's like, wait, your job is to protect the citizens and their rights. And obey the law yourself. Make sure people obey it. You think you're above the law, do you? Like you're only there to punish other people for breaking the law, right? It's like
and that's,
one way
you know,
system.
If I get really back to my model or my take on this is that, you know, that the police are really there to protect the white minority, the whites at the top of the system. They're a buffer between the poor and the people of color and the rich whites at the top. That's my belief, is they really serve those guys.
The people that seem valuable in maintaining their jobs. So I wouldn't be as specific as to just say white or rich. I think it's just as simple as that.
Right, yeah. And I mean, we know that historically in this country, it's been white. I mean, you've got your Oprah Winfrey and you've got
for
your
sure.
There's
Michael
definitely Jordan.
That,
but they're... You know, got two or three black people that are super rich, and then the rest are all white. And, you know, so, and it's not, I mean, you know, Bill Gates may be a nice guy. He claims to put all this money into education, but then he funds charter schools. I don't know what to think about. I do know what to think. I don't like Bill Gates, but blame him personally for something this, where the police are basically in the pocket of a certain class in the city. They're not really on the side of the people, African Americans or even working class white people. They're there to protect a limited range of interests.
And I think it's more like on the classism chip too.
Yeah.
Like it seems like, okay, well, if it's like I said, like they're protecting their own interests and their job security, basically, the people that ensure that happen to be these wealthy white men. But I think it's really down to classism, because if you say, okay, well, here's the easy target. Let's separate their families and give them little options to prosper. Let's make sure we keep that power structure and just make sure we incarcerate as many as possible. Then, I mean, that's the kind of system they're protecting. So if anyone doesn't agree with that, and they don't want it to be that way, then it has to be very different than what it is now, you know?
Right.
Like, there has to be some way to ensure that it doesn't happen. I used to have a strategy.
Mm-hmm. It kind of fell apart. I used to believe that, you know, what we needed to do was, you know, get everybody into a union. And that was a part of the Obama plan. He was going to get everybody the right to get into a union. He was going to beef up education. All these things, he was going to, of course, universal health care. He had all these plans. And then the Republican Congress prevented any of them from going through. And I don't think it was just the Republicans. There are Democrats who are on the other side of this, like, you know, well, we don't want to make it easy to join a union. We don't want to, you know, because, and you know, I don't know how much, and again, the other thing is, one of the harder nuts, I mean, if everybody can join a union, then their jobs are become more secure. That's just a fact.
Yeah.
But what do you do about the people who have a hard time even getting a job? You know, and that's where, you know, the job statistics is that most people work overtime. Well, why don't we cut back on that overtime and give people more jobs, right? Put more people to work and cut down on the overtime. But for whatever reason, apparently it's more profitable to overwork somebody than to have more people doing, you know, spreading the hours around. For whatever reason, that seems to be the way capital goes. And I've read an article here and there that's the employers prefer not to hire new people. They prefer to make the people they have work longer.
Because it's a questionable thing sometimes. You invest in an employee and they are not going to be beneficial to your company. So then, you've wasted time and you have to replace that person.
But then you've got this big population who can't find a job. I think that's really at the root of what's going on in the African American community.
It's hard for me to stay in that mindset just a little bit. But I know I'm very radical on my views. But to me, it's like even bigger than that. Because for my survival, for instance, I don't depend on necessarily a job. I need my my needs need to be taken care of. Okay, and I need to be comfortable. These things are not necessarily dependent on a job. So if it was possible, I feel like we could cut through a lot of the bureaucracy that would be needed to do something like some sort of new jobs plan. We can just provide each other, well, one, share skills. I think apprenticeship is really underrated. We have a lot of elderly people out there with knowledge, and we have people that are out of work because they are too qualified and too, you know, too old, frankly, to get hired back into the market. And then we have young people that have nothing better to do after they're done with school or if they're not in school.
Right.
And then there's people that can't find a job that are just out of school or in between. So, like, let's be creative about this. Let's, like, plug in where there is need. You know, there's people with this information and there's people that want it. And I really feel like a community solution is, like, a really big branch we can start to get to that place we want to be. It'd be great if we can create a lot of jobs, and I think that's possible to me. Maybe that's outside of my expertise, but I just know sometimes we get caught up in this idea of, like, oh, you gotta make money, you gotta, like, go on the clock, and it's like, we're human beings, like, let's not forget that. So, like, for instance, you don't need as much money to pay for groceries if you know how to have a garden in the spring, summer, fall, and even some crops in the winter. You don't have to spend a lot of money on things that are going to break and not even work right if you share tools with your neighbors. Like, you don't have to go to some expensive school and go into debt if you can learn the same thing. If it's something that doesn't require, you know, a special kind of doctorate or something special like that, like, a lot of things you can actually start working right away. And there's, now it's the computer age, there's so many different jobs, and people were creative or human. So, like, my kind of logistics with creating some sort of solution out of this mess is to, like, kind of disassociate from that system. But I know we differ a little bit on that. But everyone's going to fit in where they want to fall in. I think there's a lot of different ways we can try to go about it.
Yeah.
But to me, that seems like a good idea, because if you're a strong community, then you're harder to kind of break. And
yeah.
you're going to put your heads together and share your strengths as opposed to just kind of being in the defensive all the time and having to
yeah.
struggle so much. Like, let's use what we have and help each other. And that's not
yeah.
just exclusive for the Black community, but it's definitely necessary.
Right. Right.
And anyone who wants to help,
you and I both probably have similar, although I'm not quite into the, I want to have a garden to grow my own vegetables. I never went that route, but I've never
okay.
been rich. I'm now
I'm
at 53 and I'm finally finishing a call, or becoming 53 in a couple of weeks, a couple of months.
You are becoming
so
53.
Yeah, I will be 53 in March. And I feel every year now, you know, when you reach a certain age, you feel every year. and so I didn't get a degree. And one of the reasons I never got a degree is I kept running out of money. And I was not the kind of person who was going to go deep into debt. So I've had a job
yeah.
for 12 plus years at my company, 12 and a half now. I don't like the job.
Yeah.
It's okay. I don't hate it. And I can do it. And I can do it well. And I even sometimes... You know, if I'm in a, you know, in a particular point, I can actually do well enough that my, you know, I get written up as great employee or whatever. You know, although they complain that I don't like to do overtime. But anyway, that's another thing. But when I think of, I had advantages. I was born into a family where my father had a college education. My mother...
Mm-hmm.
did they both had college educations. Of course, they got educations during the whole 60s when there was a lot of government grants to get people into college. And so they both finished their degrees that way at private colleges. So I had an example like that, even though they were not, their parents were not really college educated. I should say it was mixed. My grandmother, my mother's mother, had a college degree. Her husband did not. My mom's father did not have a college degree. So, and they always lived on a farm, and he was a truck driver, and so they never really had money. So he has this perception of growing up poor, but she went to school and, you know, was trying to become middle class. My dad was similar. His grandfather came out of my father's father came out of the Depression. Became a preacher and a used car dealer. That's how he made his living. But, you know, never a lot of money. But, you know, nevertheless, there was, like I said, a certain amount of community. And he, you know, they did okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to grow off of that and not fall into homelessness. Although there were points
right.
at which I probably was on the edge of homelessness because I had a hard time holding jobs for many years. And so I know what it's like to grow up in a situation, and so when I think of it, it was hard for me growing up with a more or less intact family. It was dysfunctional, but intact. And when you think of the number of African Americans who grew up with, you know, their fathers are in jail or on the streets because they can't, you know, public aid. If the mother is on public aid, she can't have a man living in the house. You know, so all these, you know, these mm-hmm. things that keep them. You know, keep the African American family sort of stretched,
yeah.
and then the daily racism. We talk about it. The daily racism.
You know, I forgot about
you know,
that. I almost forgot about
it's
that.
It's got to drive you down. Yeah.
You know what? That's something really I remember a lot from growing up from my housing project, because there
yeah.
were a lot of those kind of rules. I remember that. That's really weird.
Yeah.
I totally forgot about that. There's also like a lot of factors. There's really a lot of factors that go into basically making Black families are really dissected a lot by this kind
yeah.
of social structures. And there's a lot of factors. It's, you know, it's personal relationships too. It's like, but the family
yeah.
structure, if somebody's in jail and they're the father and
yeah.
the woman's raising kids by themselves, and it's
yeah.
over drugs. Like, okay, if we can fix so many of these situations, it's based on a nonviolent
yeah.
crime. Like,
I
just want to know, like, the justification that anyone would have against that. Like, I don't really
yeah.
get it.
Yeah, and I mean, this is why to me the African American population in the United States is different than the Mexican immigrant population, because although Mexican, there's a sad story there about the Native Americans were then dominated by the Spaniards and they intermarried, but it's interesting, if you go to pretty much any Latin or Spanish speaking country, they've got a racial divide too. You know, they're the very poor blacks still speak, they're the children of slaves, and that's the thing. Most African Americans, whether they're Latin Americans or North Americans, come over here through this big theft of human lives from Africa, and they come over here and rather than keep them in family groups, they were thrown in a ship, and hardly anybody spoke their language. And that was deliberate, to keep slaves from different tribes not together, so that they couldn't form a community. They had to, learn English. Right. They had to get a new name and, marry somebody that was totally didn't speak their language.
It goes really deep.
There's a term that I learned. There's an African term called the Ma'afa. The Ma'afa is what they call that period where Europeans and North Americans just stole human beings from the continent and then put them in parts of Europe, but mostly concentrated in the United States and the Caribbean, some in South America or Latin America, and just basically chewed their lives to shreds so that all they were a body with arms.
Sure.
So that they could work.
Yeah, sure.
That's all they were. They were a tool. They were not a human being. They were degraded. That's why I'm so impressed by African American achievement to this point. It won't be me. It won't even. I mean, you're closer to it in some ways than I am. It won't. It'll be. Again, I look back at King. I look back at the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Even someone like Malcolm X. These people fought against a garbage situation, and were able to break through a little bit. And I'm just hoping that. I believe, I have faith, I'm not hoping, I really think there is still that strength and steel in the African-American community, and I think they will figure out how to start pushing forward again.
I hear all that, and I'm really glad to go into that for people that might not think about it in that sort of depth, like how far it goes back. And just to bring it forward, I feel like the most important thing that I would want people to take from this this struggle, and instead of getting really down about it or angry about it, hurtful, divisive, I think it's really important to just kind of make some sort of commitment to wherever it seems like it makes sense on any level that somebody can do. Like, you have to do something to change this. It's not just going to go away. So, whatever you have to do. If it's if they're making prayers, if they're having a moment of silence, if they're making music, they're making art, if they're changing their behaviors, if they're supporting black businesses, if they're getting together to try to raise awareness in communities about just needs, sharing, caring, all that good stuff, great. Mm-hmm. But to just be upset about it, it's important, but it's really not going to change anything, and that's just a fact. So I just want to say that.
I'm going to wrap up with, because we've got 5 minutes left, I'm going to go back to the Selma movie. My wife and I went to it. We got invited by another African-American pastor who said, I want to have everybody I know go at the same time. So we all went, and there were 30 of us, 30 people I knew at this movie, and that's never happened to me before. And we were all in tears. We were cheering. I don't know what this – I can't yet. Maybe it's still too new. It just happened this afternoon. But that's why I have hope. That's why I have faith. And I'm more white people, every white person needs to see this movie and see it a couple of times to get your – get yourselves out of the idea that the African-American community has doesn't have its own resources and power. They do. And we need to stop getting in their way. We need to, you know, we need to recognize their humanity and their strength. And it's a fabulous movie. Go see it. That's my plug. I don't make any money, I swear. But it's given me, when I get discouraged, I can think about, that's what I have to do. I have to look back. I know in the past we fought and we've won things, and African Americans have done it, and white people have fought alongside, at least some of us have, and I'm hoping that, you know, whatever little way I can contribute, I want to do that. Well, do you have, we're with 4 minutes. I'll give you a last word, but I do want to bring up next topic. Are you going to be in town in 2 weeks?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So I've invited my friend Dwight Welch, who is a pastor in Oklahoma. He's a United Church of Christ pastor. I've known him for a few years, mainly through online, but we've actually met face-to-face once at a conference. And he wrote a blog post about God. And as you may remember from, we've discussed God maybe once or twice on here, and I have I'm not quite on board with the whole God idea. I used to be, and so I decided I'm going to dedicate the whole show to the concept of God next time. So if you want to, you know, and I'll maybe send you a link to what he wrote. He's written actually, I think, 2 postings now on his blog about God and what he believes about God, you know, he's somebody who I think is open-minded enough that I can have a conversation with him. Well, here's why I'm not totally comfortable with God talk, but, you know, so that'll be interesting in 2 weeks. We got 3 minutes. I'm going to let you have them, at least a few of them, and just, you know, what's on your mind, after the conversation today, or what would you like to see us do going forward? I'm glad you're back, and hopefully we can do this together regularly.
It was really nice to have the talk, and of course, I don't know, like, I always feel like I want more time to chat about things with you. Because it's interesting to hear your perspective on things and to share. I was just thinking, I was just wanting to maybe talk about philosophy when it comes to Quakerism in relation to this idea of power, because one of the things that was really profound to me and has helped me with just what I feel is like kind of a spiritual resonance is this idea of this non-hierarchical structure and how power is just, I feel like, really balanced well.
Right.
But of course there's disagreements within that too. And, you know, just kind of our relation with Quaker philosophy and with what we were talking about would have been interesting, but maybe another time.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You did say that, and we didn't directly address the Quaker thing. I haven't done a Quaker theme show since we came back, but that certainly we could.
I'm just curious. I'm over here talking about it.
Yeah. Well, I don't have anything. I actually don't have anything set up yet after the next one, because I was kind of, you know, we can talk. Privately, we can talk privately offline about
there's that,
emailing over about, you know, here, let's set up a couple more topics, but definitely we could talk about Quakers, and we can talk about power, you know, because that, I realized we went the totally more my direction, which was the racism question, but we talked a little bit about power, but power and religion would be an interesting topic, and how Quakers.
It's a very complicated subject, so it's okay. We would need hours. You and I
would
especially.
Love to do it.
Talking
I'd love
Quakers.
To do it again. Maybe we'll put that on in 2 weeks, or I've kind of half promised some other people that I'll bring them on the show. So we'll get to, but I'll keep that. That definitely could be one of the next 2 or 3 topics. So,
cool.
Anyway, we're out of time.
Thanks for listening.
I want to keep it to an hour. We used to go 90 minutes, but I think I want to make this low stress. So we're doing 1 hour every other week instead of 90 minutes every week. That was too much. So thank you again. Thanks, everybody, for listening in. The archive will be posted shortly after we end the broadcast here. And, you know, if this show takes off, eventually, you know, maybe we'll make it fancier. Right now it's pretty bare bones, but thank you for tuning in to the Radical Righteous Love webcast.
Love.
Good night, Shante. All
good
right.
Night, good night, Trent. Good night, brother. Peace to you.